You're listening to The Exchange. I'm Mary Hartnett. On Tuesday, Iowa had its deadliest day so far since the coronavirus hit the state. Governor Kim Reynolds announced that a daily record of 19 more Iowans had died from COVID-19, bringing the statewide total over 200. The previous daily record came last Wednesday when Iowa reported 14 COVID-19 deaths. A drive-through COVID-19 testing site began operations Monday on the Western Iowa Tech Community College campus. Also, Governor Kim Reynolds will talk to President Trump this week on a trip to Washington about how the state is working with meatpacking plants to try and counter deadly outbreaks. At one of her press conferences this week, Reynolds included information from the Iowa Department of Public Health of manufacturing companies where more than 10% of workers have tested positive for the virus. They included meatpacking plants in Columbus Junction, Tama, Perry, Waterloo, and a windmill factory in Newton. In Siouxland, a Tyson plant in Dakota City across the bridge in Nebraska shut down operations after 669 workers tested positive for the virus. Tyson is working on testing all of its workers, cleaning, and making the plant safer for all workers with social distancing and personal protective equipment. In response to worker shortages at meatpacking plants and an increase in meat sales, Hy-Vee stores are limiting purchases of meat at all locations starting Wednesday. And the West Des Moines-based company announced in a news release that customers will be limited to 4 packages of a combination of fresh beef, ground beef, pork, and chicken. And Costco announced similar limits this week. Many Iowa lawmakers have expressed concerns about the large number of COVID-19 infections at Iowa and regional packing plants. Sioux City State Senator Jackie Smith last week called for an independent body to oversee the reopening of Tyson Fresh Meat's Dakota City plant to ensure it's a safe place to work. Smith says Tyson created this disaster by failing to protect workers, and independent experts need to oversee what she says would be an intensive ongoing effort to make the plant a safe place to work.
Tyson might want it as well to assure the public, you know, that their workers are being treated safely, that the food supply, you know, is safe. So there's good reasons. And we don't probably have the capacity right now, but it is something that I think all industries, especially the food processing, they're going to have to figure out a new way of doing business. So right now, it could be, you know, this particular plant in Dakota City, it could be University of Nebraska could do it. I don't know what they're doing, if they're involved at all. I know the University of Iowa, you know, is capable in Iowa of running something like that. You could have OSHA do it, Department of Agriculture. I mean, I think there's a perhaps private business. So I don't know if I really had it formulated in my head, the who, but just the fact that there would be continual testing and then mitigation of those that are, testing positive, you know, so they can get back to work. There's no one more than me that want the packing plants up and running, but I want them up and running safely. And they do have a long history of exploiting their workers. They really do.
So do you think that Tyson should have done something when they saw these COVID infections in other factories?
They saw what was happening in the eastern side of the state and South Dakota. And right then and there, you know, they had an opportunity to even stop, provide everyone with PPE, social distancing. Now, of course, they would have to slow their production down because the way, as you know, that the food comes out, it comes out pretty quickly and they stand shoulder to shoulder. And so I don't know, you know, this is kind of a weird comparison, but oddly enough, I was reading something and I think it came off of actually an NPR show that I was listening to, and they were talking about the adult film industry of all things and being tested every 2 weeks for STIs or STDs. And it goes into a national database. You know, if they test positive, they cannot work. It's already semi set up in that industry. And not that we would look to the adult film industry normally for a model of anything, but it might be something that could work along that line going forward, because I think life as we knew it is over. I just think there's going to be a lot of changes as far as how business is conducted, at least for a good long while, until we get a vaccine. And then, of course, we'll be afraid another pandemic of some kind will show up, because they seem to be pretty stubborn little viruses.
I was certainly surprised when I heard that 669 cases were at the Dakota City plant last week. And then in Indiana, at a Tyson plant in Logansport, Indiana, there were more than 900 cases. And Tyson has certainly been sort of, you know, right in the headlights in this situation.
They have been. And they're certainly not the only, meat processor. We have Seaboard, and we have yet to get any, good information out of there. But I don't know why they wouldn't be susceptible to the same things that Tyson workers are, exposed to. So, yeah, Tyson has, because they're so large, they're one of the three largest processing plants, or I think, in the United States. So, yeah, they're in the headlines, and they need to step up their game. And I think they have somewhat, I don't want to put all the blame on them, because it's not all their, they didn't create this necessarily, but they didn't mitigate it either.
Yeah. And I know they have a lot of immigrant workers and new citizen workers from Latino, Latin areas in the world, South America, Mexico. And a lot of advocates for Latin Americans are saying, well, you're not treating your workers correctly, and you're allowing them to be in an atmosphere where they could get really sick. And I think that's become an issue as well.
Yes, they have gotten really sick. I mean, we've seen that's what has happened. And the workers are afraid, and when you are getting a bonus not to miss your shift, you go to work sick. I mean, these people are not making very much money to begin with. And of course, they would do what most hardworking families would do. If you can make a little extra money, you do. They were motivated by money and put their health second, I guess. And I'm not sure what good information they're getting. Because of a language barrier, or just for whatever reasons within the plants. I just think there's opportunity for our community as a whole to, talk and reach out and support each other on this issue of making it a safe community, because it really is what's causing the spike in illnesses around here. It's the processing plants. I hope it does work itself out, but it's not going to work itself out unless practices are different than what they were before. And that means constant testing and then mitigation testing. And I have said to some of my friends on both sides of the political spectrum that if we have to pay a little bit more for our meat, I'm okay with that. If it means that it's a safer working condition for the people that are actually getting the food to our table.
That was Sioux City State Senator Jackie Smith talking about her suggestion that a task force of independent experts should oversee an intensive effort to make the Dakota City Tyson Foods plant safer. The plant is now shut down after nearly 670 workers tested positive for the coronavirus. And one of the country's largest Latino organizations is calling for a boycott of processed meat due to the outbreaks of the coronavirus at meatpacking plants. Now the League of United Latin American Citizens is calling on consumers to join the effort they're calling Meatless May. Joe Enriquez Henry leads the Des Moines chapter of LULAC. Henry compared the packing plants to sweatshops and said they are basically incubators for the coronavirus.
This is not rocket science. Some of the things that need to be done are easy to do. They have to just slow down the speed of the work and separate the workers at least 6 feet apart. Those two things they're struggling on, these companies, because they're, well, in my opinion, placing profit before the safety of the workers. You have to do it, especially if safety gear is provided to the workers. They need to be able to work at a slower pace because they will have a lot of gear on that will protect them. But you know, you can't work at a fast pace. Your body is heating up. If you have a mask on, you're going to be breathing deeper. You're going to need to be at a slower pace in order to breathe comfortably. And at the same time, you know, you have to work at a slower pace, because if you don't, then your body heats up and then you sweat.
Henry says packing plant workers are still being forced to speed up their work, which is creating a lot of safety and health issues.
They're perspiring. They're literally sweating out of their gear onto the meat that they're cutting. And they're feeling sick because they're literally suffocating with the gear that's provided, because they're still being told to work fast and to work next to each other. So those two big items need to be resolved, along with mandatory testing. And then workers need to know who got sick so that they can get them, be aware of that, and then also take time off.
Henry says workers are not willing to take a day off because they'll lose a day's pay.
And you probably don't know this, but most workers don't even get paid for time off. And if they do, it's not much. It would be less than $200 for time off in a week. That's not enough to pay the bills. So there needs to be full pay during sick leave, and then health care with no deductibles, because a lot of these workers have to pay $5,000 to $10,000 out of pocket before their health care kicks in.
That was Joe Enriquez Henry, the political director for the Iowa chapter of the League of United Latin American Citizens, talking about the working environment in packing plants. LULAC is calling for a boycott on meat products during the month of May to call attention to the problem. Latino Americans make up only about 3% of the population of Iowa, but they account for 23% of the confirmed cases of the coronavirus in the state. African Americans are also disproportionately affected by COVID-19. They make up 4% of the population, but account for 13% of the cases. Betty Andrews is the head of the Iowa and Nebraska branch of the NAACP. Andrews says early on in the epidemic, she saw a great deal of disconcerting reports of large numbers of African Americans and other minorities being affected by the coronavirus.
And it became of great concern to us in Iowa, because we then also began getting anecdotal reports for me, I know several people who have relatives and in some cases multiple relatives that have passed on from this virus. The NAACP received a lot of concerns around this issue. And so it was very important to us to be able to take a look at the numbers, which at that time were not being displayed and or not being presented by the governor. But we did write a letter, and those numbers shortly after were made available. So we're thankful for that, but it is certainly something that we have been looking at, and it is a great challenge to us.
What do you think can be done to try and bring not just awareness, but actually do something, bring maybe some more services, more health care?
Obviously the first thing and for us would be the availability of testing. And so if more tests are made available in communities of color, that will help, because we'll be able to track the disease a lot better. And then also making sure that when people from communities of color present at their healthcare facility or their physician or primary health provider, that they are believed when it comes to their symptoms. And then also, once people are diagnosed, that they do get proper care. Those things are very important. But then also making sure that the information is available and also available not only through the traditional means, but also maybe digging a little deeper. I've been in contact with a couple of our African-American stations, and they report that there really hasn't been any reach out from the government to utilize them to educate people, although they are doing so on their own. But I think with all of the means available, that because this really is a sensitive issue, that people, the government should reach out to the more vulnerable community.
Is it hard in a way because the government at times, and whether it's state government, national government, whatever, sometimes doesn't have the best record for, you know, being honest and straightforward, especially with African Americans, Latino people?
So, Mary, this is why I often speak and tell people that, you know, the role of an advocate is hugely important, because obviously there are some things within the minority communities that are considered crisis even before this pandemic hit. There are health disparities, there are economic disparities, there are education disparities, and now we have this pandemic that is affecting everyone. But it is affecting people of color to a much greater extent. And this is why it is important, so that when you're looking at crisis and things like this, and when it comes to communication with systems, I know that people of color sometimes have found it challenging to navigate systems within our country, and there's a long legacy, a long history that that supports that, and it's not something that just started happening. And so with that, it creates an environment where people of color, for instance, thinking about small businesses and the loans to provide support from the federal and state government, when those loans come through traditional banking institutions, you have to realize that African Americans may not necessarily be utilizing traditional banking institutions in the same way. They may have an account there. However, in terms of loans and things like that, many businesses from communities of color, they are actually bootstrap businesses. So they're self-financed and they're not interacting with banks. And so with that lack of interacting with banks and these loans become available through banks, it creates a situation where there is no history, and it just makes things more challenging.
So this is a problem on many levels.
Yeah. And so I also wanted to, you know, just talk about, you know, even thinking about, you know, we're in a situation where schools have been canceled, and our education, the education of our children is extremely important, but minority communities tend to be poor. And when you have poor communities, there tends to be a technology gap. And that technology gap, again, is widened in situations like this. It happens in many places, whether it's economics, health, or, you know, just general well-being.
That was Betty Andrews, the head of the Iowa and Nebraska branch of the NAACP. Andrews says early on in the pandemic, she saw a great deal of disconcerting reports of large numbers of African Americans and other minorities being affected by the coronavirus, and has been asking for the help of Governor Kim Reynolds to address those issues. You're listening to The Exchange. I'm Mary Hartnett. Well, the healthcare system in the U.S. has been pushed to its limits during the COVID-19 pandemic, but some rural hospitals and clinics were in dire straits before the pandemic hit. University of Minnesota researcher Carrie Henning-Smith is a widely published researcher at the UM School of Public Health. She focuses specifically on rural issues and marginalized populations. On a conference call with reporters this week, Dr. Henning-Smith addressed many issues related to COVID-19, including the large numbers of coronavirus cases at packing plants. Henning-Smith says it's important for all meat packers to take the time to put safeguards in place for workers who are already strained by a lack of health care.
Certainly, if they're going to be open, there need to be incredible precautions taken. We need to make sure that workers can distance from one another, that they have access to masks and protective equipment to stay safe, that it's not just the plant itself. It's not just what's happening within the place of work. It's this stew of other things that we have happening in those places that have meatpacking plants. Meatpacking plants are disproportionately staffed by folks who are newer immigrants, people who are Hispanic or Latino, in many cases East African, people who have lower access to health insurance, some people who had more underlying health conditions to begin with, people who work very low wages and who live in closer quarters. And so for people under those circumstances, even without the meatpacking plant, they're more at risk because of reduced access to health care and because it's harder to distance themselves with one another. You add on the meatpacking and people needing to work close with one another, and it's just a really volatile situation that we are seeing play out in tragic ways throughout the Midwest and beyond.
Henning says she's very concerned about the effect of COVID on the food chain, as well as the safety of the workers.
In terms of getting PPE and other staff or other equipment to people working in the meatpacking places that you don't want to align with any one particular corporation, working through the unions would be a good approach. You may also want to talk with the state office of health or the rural health association within each of the states that the meatpacking plants are located in, and they would have some ideas for you about the best way to access and distribute those.
Henning was asked about the recent opening up of major parts of states like Iowa and the effect on rural areas as the number of COVID-19 cases grows.
I worry a lot about that issue too, and I think we're seeing that play out in real time. Some of the states where we're seeing a dramatic increase in rural cases are some of the same states where we're seeing loosening of social distancing requirements, places like Georgia and Tennessee. And I think farmers have every right to be concerned about their well-being as we loosen those restrictions. I don't know that the onus should be on farmers to solve this problem, but I think it's important for you and the media to raise up their concerns and their voices so that we can make sure that they're heard and advocated for. Farmers already face incredible challenges for a number of reasons unrelated to COVID-19. And this is only adding on to that. We're seeing this play out in heartbreaking ways as farmers are asked to slaughter hogs because the meat packing plants are closed and they can't process those orders. We're seeing disruption to the dairy industry, certainly to people who grow crops. And I worry that that's not going to get any better anytime soon without a lot of attention and advocacy to that population.
Henning was also asked how to compare large, less populous counties, like the ones that make up most of Northwest Iowa, to more populous counties.
I think that we sometimes assume that because people in rural places live farther from one another, the population isn't as dense as we see in New York City, certainly, that people are insulated and safer from this. And that makes me concerned. I think in some rural areas, the message hasn't been communicated clearly enough that everyone is potentially at risk. And rural areas, because of some of the infrastructure challenges I mentioned earlier, such as lack of access to broadband internet, it's harder in rural areas to go through your daily life and not have to leave your home. It's a lot harder to be able to order groceries to be delivered to your door. You're still going to have to be going out and interacting with one another for your job, potentially, to access your daily needs and your daily resources. And so people are still going to be needing to interact with one another, and the risk does not go away because of that. So any way that we can communicate that more clearly to rural people and rural populations is a great service.
Henning says in rural counties, people may have a false sense of security when it comes to the spread of the coronavirus.
And that makes me concerned. I think in some rural areas, the message hasn't been communicated clearly enough that everyone is potentially at risk. And rural areas, because of some of the infrastructure challenges I mentioned earlier, such as lack of access to broadband internet, it's harder in rural areas to go through your daily life and not have to leave your home. It's a lot harder to be able to order groceries to be delivered to your door. You're still going to have to be going out and interacting with one another for your job, potentially, to access your daily needs and your daily resources. And so people are still going to be needing to interact with one another, and the risk does not go away because of that. So any way that we can communicate that more clearly to rural people and rural populations is a great service.
That was University of Minnesota researcher Carrie Henning-Smith. Dr. Henning-Smith is a widely published researcher at the UM School of Public Health. She focuses specifically on rural issues and marginalized populations. This week, she answered reporters' questions about the spread of COVID-19 in rural areas and issues that affect workers in packing plants where the coronavirus has been spreading in recent weeks. Support for The Exchange comes from Gregory Giles, investment advisor representative with Legacy Financial LLC in Sioux City, serving the financial planning and investment needs of clients since 2004. Information about Legacy Financial and Greg Giles is available at legacyfinancialllc.com. Financial planning and advisory services offered through RDA Financial Network. You're listening to The Exchange. I'm Mary Hartnett. The COVID-19 modeling team at the University of Iowa has taken a multidisciplinary, multimodal approach to estimating the progression of the COVID-19 outbreaks in the state. The team is currently developing and evaluating three models. M1 is a short-term prediction model for one-week forecasts. M2 is a medium-term prediction model. And M3 is a model designed to evaluate policy changes related to non-pharmaceutical interventions. Grant Brown is an assistant professor of biostatistics at the University of Iowa College of Public Health. Brown worked on Model 3, and he says that model has several advantages.
So the general idea behind M3 was to build, sort of from the ground up, a model for COVID based on arguments and assumptions about contact behavior. Because at the core of every epidemic is this idea of a contact, and the definition of an epidemiologically significant contact varies from pathogen to pathogen. But there is some fairly compelling data in the literature about how people in real social networks in the world tend to contact one another and at what rate and what that distribution looks like. And so that model, from those sort of first principles, builds up simulations and tries to fit them to the observed data looking at that contact behavior. And the real advantage of that is that it can help play out sort of alternative scenarios. It allows us to look at changing that contact distribution over time, for example, by the imposition of social distancing, by policies that close certain businesses, and then by the later relaxation of those policies. And it gives us a general idea of the sort of range of outcomes one would expect based on those assumptions about changes in contact.
It does kind of seem like the use of PPE, the prolonged use of personal protective equipment, and also the social distancing and not being in the big crowds, if we continue to do that, it looks like that could really bring down the mortality and maybe even prevent a second peak.
So predicting long-term in an epidemic like this is extraordinarily difficult. Because not only is the virus itself propagating in a really complex environment, human societies, and Iowa's no exception, are really, really complex, but the environment is actually changing in response to the virus all the time. And so the further out we go, the more difficult it becomes to say anything with certainty. And a good example of that is things like a second peak. So currently, our best estimates say that we haven't reached our current peak in Iowa. And so it's difficult to talk about what a second peak would look like until we have observed a very robust signal telling us that we are over the first peak and that the virus has been brought under control. Now, with that being said, there is data available on mitigation strategies, right? So our models don't directly provide evidence about things like universal PPE, for example, or a particular type of social distancing policy. They look at hypotheticals in the case of the third model, and in the case of the second model, they look at sort of averages. What can we see in the data about what's happening in Iowa? And what's happening in Iowa is a mix of things. We have different PPE policies at a variety of businesses. There are some policies at the state level about what businesses can be open. There's general advisories and public health advisories for the citizens of Iowa to pursue social distancing in their own lives. And so the combined effect of all of those things shows up in our second model as an estimate of what we think the current epidemic behavior is. There are members on our team that do research in healthcare settings, however, on things like PPE. And so those are the types of interventions we've focused on and described in terms of their expected effects. But what our models provide is not sort of a comprehensive study of the effect of PPE.
But I did get the feeling that using PPE more effectively and keeping up with social distancing might be really helpful in stopping the spread and eventually, hopefully, the mortality of this disease.
I would say that what we observe is certainly clear evidence that the social distancing and combination of prevention efforts that have taken place in the state of Iowa have definitely had a positive impact, have had a beneficial impact on containing the spread of COVID-19 in the state. It's not clear whether or not it's been sufficient. And I think we'll learn more in the coming days and weeks, and we'll be extending our models to try to account for changes in policy. But certainly, anytime we have the opportunity to lower the contact rate, which can take the form of social distancing or the use of PPE in appropriate ways, can definitely benefit, reduce the number of cases and correspondingly the number of deaths. That's certainly true.
Well, up here in Northwest Iowa, most of the state is, most of the counties have more latitude now. It's the first day of May. Woodbury County does not, because we've had this huge growth in cases. A lot of the issues up here have to do with sort of the problem of transmission in the packing plants. But here in Woodbury County, we're still more locked down. People are wearing masks. You know, people are not gathering really, and I have to think that's probably a good thing for us. It's a good thing that we're not open.
So, without commenting on a specific policy, because I haven't studied that specifically, I think that you've highlighted one of the important limitations of the current work that we're doing. Currently, using this publicly available data, we've focused on the state of Iowa as a whole. And of course, the reality is much more complex. Different communities have different features. There are different industries, and different communities have responded in different ways to the outbreak. And so moving forward, we're going to be trying to do something more nuanced. But for the moment, it's sort of a large 30,000 foot view of what the epidemic looks like in Iowa based on the best available information.
That was Grant Brown, an assistant professor of biostatistics at the University of Iowa College of Public Health. Brown is working on a statistical model of the spread of COVID-19 across the state. His model shows that interventions like social distancing and wearing face shields could make a difference in the spread of the coronavirus. You're listening to The Exchange. I'm Mary Hartnett. The Federal Emergency Management Agency is known to Iowans for helping out in all kinds of natural disasters like tornadoes and massive flooding. However, FEMA has also been instrumental in providing aid during the coronavirus pandemic, delivering personal protective equipment and helping out with testing. Deanna Frazier is an external affairs advisor with FEMA who lives in central Iowa. She says FEMA continues to provide assistance to Iowans during the COVID-19 crisis.
We provided three different shipments of personal protective equipment from the national stockpile, and that was to help with our first responders and our essential workers out there, primarily for the healthcare workers.
I saw the money too that, you know, came to individual states to help, you know, just do things like, you know, reimburse administrative costs and things. And I think those are things people forget, you know, the state takes on costs and it's sometimes it's tough to meet all those costs.
The states are put in a pretty difficult situation with this pandemic. They are putting out millions and millions of dollars in this COVID response. And so FEMA is helping with a 75-25 cost share for, you know, quite a bit of their costs. So, you know, $65 million is quite a bit of money that can go right back into the state's budget to help provide, you know, those emergency protective measures, the administrative costs like you talked about, the National Guard members that are working with Test Iowa. It involves quite a lot.
Yeah, and, you know, just today I saw them setting up their Test Iowa stuff out at Western Iowa Tech.
Yes, I saw that the governor had announced that that was going to be out there. And I imagine that, you know, she's been talking about how the National Guard has been integral in the Test Iowa initiative, getting the tests back and forth from to Iowa City to the national or to the state hygienic lab, also doing the contact tracing, that's what it's called. So the National Guard has been very integral in the contact tracing as well. And so, you know, FEMA can help with those Title 32 dollars. That's money that is spent on National Guard members that have been activated specifically for COVID-19 response.
And you guys did so much when we had all the flooding a couple years ago. And that was another one of those kind of unfolding crises in a way. It kind of reminds me of that when I look at what's happening with COVID-19, because the damage was not done in a day or even a week. I mean, it kept rolling. It took a long time to work itself out, right?
Right. If I recall, the incident period for the floods last year was like March 27th through like June 15th. I mean, that is almost unheard of to have an incident period that long. And so, like you said, the flooding from last year just unfolded over several months' time. And those numbers and dollars racked up by the state was able to be helped by FEMA obligations going back into the emergency management right here in the state of Iowa.
If people need information, they just can go to the FEMA site?
If they want information regarding FEMA involvement with the COVID-19, yes, they can go to FEMA.gov. But the best site, of course, is right here in the state of Iowa, which is coronavirus.iowa.gov.
And FEMA is also providing this crisis counseling program that the governor has been talking about in the last week.
Part of the FEMA obligation to Iowa was the crisis counseling program, and that will allow the state to tap into quite a bit of counseling for the survivors here. And, you know, because I think that that's what you have to call the folks here in Iowa, are disaster survivors of the COVID-19. And so, you know, they're going through a lot of stress in their lives and having some emotional difficulty oftentimes. And those kinds of services cost money. And FEMA is helping the state by providing those crisis counseling program dollars to them.
That was Deanna Frazier, an external affairs advisor at FEMA. She lives in Iowa. She says FEMA continues to provide assistance to Iowans during the COVID-19 crisis. The latest survey of supply managers in a 9-state region of the Midwest and Plains shows many still have hope for a rebound this year, even as the survey's other indices show the coronavirus pandemic has knocked the economy in Middle America for a loop. The Mid-American Business Conditions Index released Friday plummeted from March's 46.7 to 35 in April, the lowest reading since February 2009. But the Confidence Index, which gauges supply managers' economic outlook for the next 6 months, rose to 45.5 from March's record low 14.5. Any score above 50 suggests economic growth. Before the survey was released, Siouxland Public Media's Sheila Brummer talked to local economic expert John Jeffrey Zink about his thoughts on the pandemic and our economy. Zink is an associate professor of economics at Morningside College.
For the most part, the economy works as a flow. All right. And so you and I, we live in what economists would classify as a household. And you have a job and I have a job still so far that generates income. Right. And so this is specialized labor. And then we turn around and because we have a job, we are selling our ability to work on the labor market for which an employer pays us money. Right. So that pays us money. So that's inflow into us as a household. And then we take that money that we earn from our job and then we spend it on goods and services provided by businesses. And so we have an inflow of wages and salaries from businesses to us, and we have an outflow of payments to businesses in which we get goods and services. Okay. If there is an interruption anywhere in that circuit, then you are going to have problems. And so even though I still currently have a job and you still currently have a job, there are many, many people that obviously don't. And so as a result, when you see that happen, businesses suffer a decline in their income coming in. And so they have to cut back as well. And so businesses are essentially in a lot of ways the same position as households. If they don't have income coming in, they can't pay their employers, they can't pay their suppliers, right? And so as a result, businesses begin to have to, they look at it from a perfectly individualistic point of view, from the single business point of view, and they say, well, I still have the same cost, but I don't have any income going up. And so the natural reaction as a business person looking at it as a single entity would be to cut back. But once you do that, every business is reacting in somewhat the same way. They're looking at their costs compared to their revenues, and they're like, I can't sustain this. I have to cut back on my operations. Well, once you do that, and every business begins to think that way, then you begin to see people lay off, and you see the demand side further fall. And so that's why you have these self-generating business cycles within a capitalist economy that go down for a while and then go up. Now, most of the time, in normal circumstances, these are mild and they don't require any sort of intervention. But we've seen this one, and we see the crisis in 2008 are less normal. And so as a result, those are going to require extraordinary interventions to deal with. And so there are some possibilities out there. And you're right. I mean, Congress probably well-intentioned in terms of the programs to small businesses, but that was obviously gobbled up within, 13 days. A lot of larger corporations got in on that. And now I want to say that from that point of view, that isn't necessarily bad, because there are a lot of corporations that may not have the capital to sustain a longer term interruption in their operations. Even if we're thinking about this in terms of business, we don't just think about this in terms of, yes, they have to lay off workers, they can't pay their suppliers can't pay off, but every single one of those businesses has kind of a debt load, shall we say. And to the extent that they have a debt load and they had been servicing that debt load with the income that they had generated from revenues, then all of a sudden you have the spillover effect from the real side of the economy, where you're having people produce real things like cars, to the financial side of the economy, where all of a sudden loans and whatever credit banks had actually either provided to real businesses or speculated on for one another, that begins to go down the tube as well. And so you have a really complex feedback effect between the real physical side of the economy, or what sometimes people call Main Street, and the financial side of the economy, what people sometimes rightly or wrongly call Wall Street.
Do you have any predictions? What do you think is going to happen?
As you know, economists have predicted 9 out of the last 5 recessions, right? So our ability to predict, particularly longer term trends, is not good. I see some real problems, at least particularly in the short term. A lot of the stimulus money has first been provided to people that pay taxes. Okay, fine. There's the infrastructure. I got my stimulus money before I got my tax refund, which, as an employed college professor, I thought that was really weird. I was like, look, I don't really, you know, I personally felt weird about this. I was like, I don't really need this right now. And there are people out there that need more of this. And then some of the things that have been put on the individual rescue package, on the individual aid, you know, the checks that the Trump administration said they sent out, or, you know, the $1,200 per individual, they weren't going to go to some people either because they didn't pay taxes or they weren't citizens or whatever it is. And that just seems ridiculously punitive. Once that money runs out, we are going to find ourselves in much the same situation. You use that money and you groceries, or, you know, maybe carry out businesses. I don't know if you've seen the Facebook, the local Siouxland Eat Local Facebook group that one of my colleagues signed me up for, and I agreed. But you just postpone the inevitable unless you provide either, for example, bridge grants to businesses to enable them to, like, at the very least, if they can't sustain their operations, moratoriums on debt, things like that. And what you're going to see is you're going to see, if you don't provide some sort of support, a reshuffling, a reworking of certain kinds of particularly local businesses. And this thing that I was reading just before you called, that you're probably going to see some shakeups, some serious shakeups in the energy industry as well. But the thing is like that stimulus check that went to individual people, I mean, great. But depending on how long this goes, you might need to extend that for longer than the one-time thing that you did.
That's John Jeffrey Zink, a local economic expert. The Morningside professor talked to Sheila Bremer at length about his thoughts on the impact of COVID-19, including the energy sector, unemployment, and the impact on the U.S. dollar. Well, the long days at home have become the perfect excuse for many of us to get into the garden and revive or create a vegetable patch. There have been rumors of a lack of seeds and seedlings in Siouxland, but horticulture educator Caitlin Brinkerhoff with Iowa State University Extension and Outreach says the shortages are not as widespread as many of us might think.
In some places there has been. I know a lot more people are interested in gardening right now, so they're a little bit more apt to get out there. But you have to look in a couple different places. You can order seeds online. That's an option, just to get shipped to your house. If you go to local garden centers, or even if you go to places like Walmart and Target, they'll have seeds as well. Unfortunately, in our situation, because so many are out of stock, you might have to go to multiple stores. So that's why it's a good recommendation to maybe find a brand that you enjoy and order offline. They are there, but you might have to do some searching for them.
I was reading about, you know, how to lay out, say, a vegetable garden. And I thought to myself, I've never done this. You know, if I were to go out and try to do that, I find it somewhat... It seems like a lot to do, but I'm sure there's a way to do it that, you know, there's a way to do everything, but most of us have never maybe done this.
Yeah, it's really overwhelming at first. That's why we always recommend that you want to start small, even with a vegetable garden. And if you have a small space, it's great to just do something like container gardening. So you can just start a garden in a 5-gallon bucket, so you can grow one tomato plant in a 5-gallon bucket, one pepper plant in a 5-gallon bucket, and maybe in a bucket of herbs. And then right there you have, sometimes we call it like a little pizza garden that you have in just 3 5-gallon buckets. So it's always a little overwhelming, especially if it's something that you haven't done before and you're just jumping into it. But once you get a hang of it, it's very easy. I know a lot of people say that they don't have a green thumb, but it's something that you're able to learn. I don't think it's very possible for people to kill. Sometimes, you know, you might just not have the right soil mixture at home or the right balance in the ground to be able to keep yourself alive. So always trying a soil test and things like that will be helpful as well.
Do you get a lot of calls about gardening these days?
I do. A little less just because our office is closed, but I still am getting plenty of calls and emails. I have master gardeners around in the community, and they are still getting asked questions by their neighbors, friends. They'll give them calls as well. So there are a few people that I've noticed that are just starting out this year at gardening. With the pandemic that we had, they felt like they would have a little bit more food security if they were able to grow it on their own. So still lots of questions coming in.
I know a lot of people who just find it very relaxing and something they can do with their kids and get them outside and away from, you know, the phones and the screens and all that.
Yeah, it's definitely a great way to get outdoors and exercise, get your vitamin D. It's a very healthy thing for you to be doing. So, yeah, I mean, it's always just important to remember that, you know, you don't have to be scared of gardening. It's not a hard thing, and you can learn. We have so many resources through Iowa State University Extension and Outreach that you can utilize, or even just chatting with master gardeners to kind of help you through the process. It's something that will give you a little bit more security and provide just a great source of fresh produce for you at home, or even if you just want to do a flower garden, it can just brighten your day a little bit if you walk outside and just have a pot of flowers out there. So it's just something that's really great for you and something not to be scared of.
That was Caitlin Brinkerhoff. She's a horticulture educator with Iowa State University Extension and Outreach, and she talked about gardening in the time of COVID-19. Well, that's it for this edition of The Exchange. I'm Mary Hartnett. We'll see you next week. Thanks a lot to Sheila Brummer and Steve Smith.